It's February 26, 2013. The first thing in our agenda is the approval of the minutes. Motion to approve the minutes. Has anyone read them? Senator Thompson moves that the minutes be approved. Just make sure they spell your name right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Okay, we'll take Senator Stevens' bill first, and then we'll take Senator Hortman's bill, if she's here, second.
And Representative Dean is here. Sandy.
Okay. And which bill is he got?
White Bear.
Okay. Senator Sieben, Representative Kahn, welcome to the Pension Commission. If you'd like to make some opening comments, and then we can hear from your witnesses, and our staff will fill in any necessary details.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Representative Kahn and I have before you today Senate File 279, which before I get into a brief explanation, perhaps we could move the Representative Kahn could move the 3A amendment.
Madam Chairman, I'll move the 3A amendment to get the bill, and it just fixed
Okay. Mr. Martin's going to pass that out.
Oh, okay.
How you doing?
Is that the same as
Madam Chair?
1A included in the 3A?
No.
Do we need to do 3A2?
Yes, we need to do the 1A.
Senator Kahn moves we'll take this as an author's amendment, moves the 3A amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. We also have a 1A amendment, which just deletes, changes the year page. It's in your packet. The bill is at the very last page, and the A1 is the second to the last page. It changes on 215, a mistaken date, August 1st, 2012, to August 1st, 2013.
Madam Chair, I'll move the 1A amendment.
Representative Kahn moves the 1A amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. All right.
Madam Chairman, I think what we'll do is Senator Sieben will explain the special circumstances of Jeffrey Swanson, and then we would like staff to explain the bill to us.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Mr. Jeffrey Swanson, who's to my left, is from Cottage Grove, Minnesota. And Mr. Swanson, for over 23 years, received his annual statement from MSRS informing him of his retirement options. And on every statement, they indicated that he was indeed eligible for the Rule of 90 option. And then his state of Minnesota seniority roster indicated that his classified start date was June 19th of 1989 at the time. In 1989, he called MSRS and asked if his temporary status with DOT impacted his MSRS eligibility date, and was told it did not. And he was informed that he made the deadline for the Rule of 90. So Mr. Swanson, I believe, would like to testify, but subsequently, until very recently, he was under the impression that he was eligible for the Rule of 90. And so this legislation attempts to correct that eligibility question. So with that, we could either hear from Mr. Swanson or staff to explain the technical.
Why don't we hear from Mr. Swanson?
Really?
Welcome to the commission.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify on behalf of this bill. My name is Jeffrey Joseph Swanson. My birth date is July 17, 1964. I've been a full-time state employee for over 23 years. My career began as a seasonal temporary employee with MnDOT. For the past 23 years, I have worked full-time for the Department of Human Services. Currently, I'm a member of MAPE. In 1989, after I received my first MRS statement and called to inquire about various options, it was reinforced that I was eligible for the Rule of 90. For over 23 years, I have received annual MSRS statements informing me that I was eligible for the Rule of 90. My wife and I attended an MSRS pre-retirement training in March of 2012. We met with MSRS staff, reviewed my file again, relating to me verbally and in writing that I was eligible for the rule of 90. After receiving my 2012 MRS statement, annual statement, I called MSRS because the amount was slightly off from what MSRS staff had given me the previous March. As a follow-up to my inquiry, I received a letter in August of 2012 from MSRS stating that I was not eligible for the rule of 90.
Okay.
Needless to say, my family and I were devastated by the news. MSRS. We have made personal, professional, and financial decisions based upon the information that was provided from MSRS consistently for over 23 years. Some of those issues that we had to struggle with was a level of deferred comp withholding, passing up on private sector job opportunities for myself and for my wife, house purchases, refinancing, out-of-pocket medical expenses, all were with the prism of the rule of 90 option that I was receive. I rely on MSRS as the only source of information available to me and everyone in the general retirement plan as fund managers. My family has made significant life choices based upon the assurance we have had that I would be eligible for the rule of 90. I can't begin to explain the hardship physically and emotionally on my family. My uncle and my great uncles did not make it to their 64th birthday. My family history is not one of longevity, and I have taken that into account meticulously. My plan included the 23 years of assurance that I was eligible for the rule of 90. I would be willing to pay back employee and employer share with a calculated interest.
Right.
It's important to realize that not once in the 23 years was my eligibility in the rule of 90 option questioned until I received a letter from MSRS that I initiated. Thank you again for this opportunity. I hope you will support this legislation. My family and I have relied upon MSRS to provide me with factually accurate information for many years. This has a potential to impact our lives immensely because of 23 years of misinformation from a retirement plan. Again, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Swanson. I'm sorry that this happened to you. Could we hear from MSRS, Mr. Bergstrom? Mr. Rich. Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, the Director of the State Retirement System, and I too apologize to Mr. Swanson. Everything he says is true. When he started in 1989, he was not eligible for membership in June, but when we got his appointment form, when he started in September, we coded the June 1989 date. So every time he got a statement, the statement looks at when his start date is, determine whether he was eligible for the rule of 90, and it said yes, because according to our computer system, it did look like he started in June of 1989 and was eligible. All of the statements were that way. When he did come into the office, we ran it off the computer. He was a walk-in, and so we just generated an estimate. And then after he called the last time, we did an audit of his account and did find the error. So we did clearly make an error. I can only come in with my hands up on this, and I can just apologize.
Okay, so your MSRS is supporting this legislation?
We don't support individual bills, but I certainly, if I were in the same situation, would have relied on the information as well. So it's a cost to MSRS, but it was our error.
Okay. Mr. Martin, did you want to add anything?
Members, the three A amendment that you adopted follows Mr. Swanson's offer to pay both the member and the employer contributions for the period when he was not eligible for MSRS coverage in 89 between June 18th and September of 89. So that's what you did in the 3A amendment. There is a correction that needs to be made in the 3A amendment. We recast June with more days in it than are physically possible. On page 1, line 3, The June 39th is June 30.
Representative Kahn makes that motion to change June 39 to June 30. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Do we know how much money this is going to be?
I believe Mr. Bergstrom could tell us.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, the payment to MSRS would be employee and employer contribution with interest would be $3,100.
It's worth it.
For the months of
service. Definitely worth it, but still, it's a lot of money. Mr. Kolodziejski, I kicked you off the committee table. Did you want to say anything? Okay, thanks. Any questions from anybody on the members of the committee? The commission? Yes, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'm looking here on the packet. On page 13, there's a line there that says Mr. Swanson's willing to pay back, and it says approximately 14. So I guess what is the actual amount that he's doing? Is it the 3,100 or is it the 1,400 that's 14,000? It's on page 13.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Yep, Madam Chair, I can address that. When we calculated the 14,000, shortly after he, Mr. Swanson started, he had a break in service. And we had counted that in the purchase amount, which is not included in the bill. It was for about a year, 1 month. So when we subtracted that out, you know, because we hadn't seen the draft of the legislation, so now he's just buying the 3-4 month period, and that's the 3,100. So he won't get credit for that 1 year, 1 month of service, but that's how we came up with the 14,000 when we calculated.
Any other questions? Members, are we ready to vote on this?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Kahn?
Well, I move that this be included in the omnibus bill.
Pension one. Okay, so Representative Kahn moves that Senate File 279, House File 347, as amended, be incorporated into Omnibus Bill 1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you very much, and
thank
good
you,
luck
Madam
to you,
Chair.
Mr. Swanson.
Okay,
now we'll take, is Representative Hortman here? Oh, she had another. Okay. We'll take, that's number 4 in your packet. If you'd like to come. Oh, Representative Hillstrom.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said Hortman had another bill.
They sound the same.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom. Sorry. Representative Hillstrom and Senator Eaton, number 6 in your packet.
Madam Chair, I'll move the bill for possible inclusion. Had to be for us.
Oh, we don't. I guess that must be a House habit.
You don't do that here. Okay.
Since I'm the chair, we don't do that. Would you like to just make some comments and maybe introduce your testifier?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Members, this...
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This proposal was brought to me by a constituent who found himself in a situation where both parties wanted to terminate a survivor designation, and because they were not married... and so could not divorce, there isn't a legal way in law to change that, even though both parties agree with changing that designation. So if Senator Eaton wants to make a statement, otherwise Don Carey from Brooklyn Park is here with me, Madam Chair.
Senator Eaton?
I will just let Mr. Carey speak for himself.
That's Don Carey.
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Carey, welcome
to the
commission.
Thank you for hearing my testimony. I set up my then fiance as a survival annuitant when I retired, as we were to be married and relocate. We never did marry. She changed her mind, and she decided not to quit her job, so we didn't locate. We're still a couple. In the meantime, she's maxing out her contributions to her IRA and 401k, so she's taking care of her own retirement, and we've just agreed that having the money come back to me makes sense for our long-term financials. Thank you.
Mr. Burek, what are some of the issues here?
Members, the first thing I would mention is that you may wish to consider whether these kinds of situations is sufficiently analogous to some action that the legislature took in 2010 dealing with marriage dissolutions. That legislation, which the commission did here, allows the second half of a joint survivor annuity to be rescinded and for the primary annuitant to receive a single life annuity if during a marriage dissolution situation the courts determine that there is no other feasible way to divide the marital property without getting into the retirement assets and redesignating those retirement assets. As I indicated, there is general legislation in 2010 that passed dealing with that situation. Prior to that, there were two special law situations in 87 and 94, but those received little commission deliberation. And the 87 case, it does not look like the commission considered it at all. I do raise the issue of whether this is best handled through special versus general legislation. The legislation before you is general legislation. It would impact nearly all Minnesota public pension plans. You may decide that the issue is best handled in a special law format. If so, you'd have to direct your staff to draw up that. We don't have that amendment available. I would mention that in the bill as drafted, the survivor annuity waiver language may not be adequate. All the bill says is that the individuals involved will sign a form, send the form to the executive director, and that will be the end of it. You may wish to have those statements notarized, and you may also wish to have some language in here requiring at least the offering of counseling by the pension plan administration before these forms are accepted. When an individual is named to the second half of a joint and survivor annuity, they have a legal right to that benefit, and so they are waiving a legal right. So they need to be made aware of that and the implications of doing that. If that is done, they no longer have any right to this person's annuity upon the death of the primary annuitant. So I do have an amendment that would add some requirement for the forms being notarized and the offer of counseling by the pension plan administration. I would also note that there is some actuarial impact on pension plans, so it's not a costless bill. There is a provision in current pension plan law called the bounce back. And basically what that is when someone takes a joint and survivor annuity, if the designated survivor dies before the primary annuitant, the benefit going to the primary annuitant bounces back to a higher level, the level the individual would have had if they had simply had a single life annuity rather than a joint and survivor annuity. So what will happen under this bill, if it is enacted, is that there will be more situations where bounce backs occur, and bounce backs are subsidized, so that's where the cost comes in. So it will happen more often because we don't have to have a situation where the designated survivor dies. You simply have to sign a form and waive that right. So it will happen more often and it will happen earlier, leading to more payouts at the higher single life level and for a longer duration of time. So there is some cost involved. I would suggest if you do want to take to consider this bill in the form of general legislation that you consider the -1A amendment, which is a delete all amendment to clean up some of the drafting issues. And if you wish to have the forms notarized, require that they be notarized, and require that the pension plan offer counseling to the parties regarding the implications of this change, then I would suggest also the dash 2A amendment. The 2A amendment is drawn to the 1A amendment. So if you wish to handle it in general legislation, that's what I would suggest.
What's the 3A amendment?
The 3A amendment, you could certainly consider. What I noticed in doing the work on this bill is that the bill currently before you would make this provision apply to all plans included under the combined service annuity provision. That includes the Duluth Teachers Plan and the St. Paul Teachers Plan. Presumably this bill, at least the concept for the bill, is modeled after that 2010 legislation dealing solely with marriage dissolutions. Now, that 2010 legislation, I noticed that the pension plans included there excluded Duluth and St. Paul. So you could also consider the 3A amendment as well. What 3A amendment does is it adds to the marriage dissolution provision that is currently in law, Duluth teachers and St. Paul teachers.
Thank you. Mr. Carey, what pension plan are you in?
PERA.
PERA. Ms. Vanek, do you want to comment on this? Or since it, and the other pension directors could also comment on it since it applies broadly.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Mary Mose Vanek, Director of PERA. We support the 1A and 2A amendments. They are they tighten up the provision as what was recommended by our legal advisor when she reviewed the language as it was introduced. And we do not have an objection to this bill. We have another member who is a constituent of Representative Aaron Murphy, who also has a similar situation, who came to us last year. And asked if there was any opportunity, because she had agreement with her significant other to unwind this. And Mr. Bergstrom also has a member in a similar situation. So we think it aligns with the marital marriage dissolution provision. With respect to the cost, there will be some members who bounce back who might add slight costs. There will be others who won't. The fact that we're losing the second coverage of the second life is helpful because now we're only paying one person. But Mr. Berg's right. There are some benefits where they bounce back to the single life that will add slight costs, but it's not really measurable cost to the fund.
Ms. Vanek. Sorry. Ms. Vanek, is there any reason to do a special law, or do you think the general law is going to be more helpful because there are other cases that are comparable?
Madam Chair, I think the general law would be beneficial. It for when individuals do approach us, it makes it readily available. We don't anticipate a lot of them. Most of the joint and survivor elections are married couples.
Okay. Mr. Bergstrom, did you want to add anything? Is Ms. Hacking here?
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Thompson's here. Okay.
Madam Chair, we do support Amendment 1A and 2A, and we do like the broader application. I had a participant call, and we were not able to deal with the case because of it. So we do like the broader application. We would support the legislation.
Okay. And Mr. Doan, are you comfortable with the 3A amendment? Have you seen that?
I am, Madam Chair.
Okay. And
Mr. Thompson?
TRA?
Luther Thompson, representing TRA. Yes, we're comfortable with both the 1A and the 2A amendment. We think it was important that particularly that the spouses and then divorce provision were carved out and left as is.
Is there anyone else that wants to comment? Questions from the commission. Representative Kahn.
Does anyone know why Duluth and St. Paul were left out, specifically excluded, not just left out?
Mr. Barrett?
Members,
we don't like divorce.
No, it wasn't an admin bill. When we considered the bill, there was, I believe initially it was for a single fund. And the chair at the time asked the various administrators of the plans, do they want their plans included? I can't remember if someone from First Class Senior Teachers perhaps wasn't here or whether they were and
okay.
disagreed, but okay. in any case, they were not included in that 2010 legislation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the question, I didn't hear from the Duluth teachers and the St. Paul teacher, or the...
Yeah. Mr. Daunton,
they both liked that, but what about the 3A amendment? Do they mind being included in it? I guess that was
Saint the question. Mr. Doan said he did support the 3A amendment. Is someone here from Duluth teachers?
No.
Okay.
There isn't.
But do you want to speak for them, or Representative Murphy?
No, I don't want to speak for them, and I don't want to include them.
Oh.
Oh.
Because they're not here.
Oh.
Well, Madam Chairman.
Representative Khan.
I was actually going to suggest that we do include them because it doesn't make any sense, and it's very easy to take them out. They'll certainly be here at some subsequent meeting, and there'll be plenty of time to ask, and we'll be plenty of time to take them out.
And
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, that same explanation, at some time later they will be here, and we can ask them then, and we could put them in. But in all these years since 2010, I haven't heard any remarks saying, gee, I wish we could be in that bill like everybody else.
Well, let's leave them out, and let's leave that purposely, and let's purposely hope that Mary Murphy has to carry another bill next year to put it in because they were left out of here. Teacher.
Do I hear an amendment to the 3A amendment?
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I'll move the... Do we want to do first to the 1A and the 2A first and then the 3, or does it matter which direction we do them in?
Mr. Burek, 1A first?
I assume 1A first.
1A, okay.
Madam Chair, I'll move the 1A amendment.
Representative Nelson moves the 1A amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, before we continue with Representative Nelson's amendments, I had questions of the directors.
Okay.
On the main part of the whole idea.
Okay.
How often does a situation like this arise?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, very infrequently. There's only one case that I'm aware of that with MSRS that it would apply. There likely would be others. I think Ms. Vanek said there were two that she's aware of. So it's very infrequent. Even the maritals, the change where a spouse can go back to court and do the same thing, we've only had a few cases since that's been enacted.
Do you want to hear from anyone else?
No, I don't, ma'am.
Okay. Representative O'Driscoll, do you remember?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I've been pondering this because first of all, didn't know that PERA or MSRS or any of our pensions would allow a non-spouse to be a designated survivor. So I've learned something here this evening, and as I ponder that, I come to the conclusion or the set of questions, I guess, and I'm hoping that it's somebody can answer the question. If you are either a spouse who's seeking a dissolution of a marriage and you're wanting to remove the other spouse from benefit, or in the situation that we have before us, are you allowed to redesignate another beneficiary?
Mr. Burek?
Members, my understanding is no.
But on the other hand, you don't have to. You can designate initially anyone you want. It doesn't have to be a spouse or a...
Correct.
Or a significant other, or it can be anyone.
Mom.
Mom, your children. Right. Mr. Representative O'Driscoll.
No, thank you. And that's why I guess I was wondering is in a situation that could potentially be where you've designated someone who was going to be the recipient that wasn't the spouse, and that person has taken ill or there's imminent death, and that you would want to remove that individual and put another individual in, or a child or something along that line. I guess I want to just make sure that if... For lack of a better term, one and done. That's you get one designee, and if you decide that you don't want to do that, then you don't get a future designee.
Is this a question or a statement?
A little bit of both.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, Representative Nelson.
If you look at the A2 amendment, at least the way I'm reading, and maybe staff can correct me, it says on line 111, subdivision 5, it says prohibition against further annuity revisions. No retired or disabled annuitant who waives the annuity is able to, at a later date, put somebody on. That's, if I read that correctly, that's what it says.
Mr. Chair and members, right.
Did he say Mr. Chair?
I believe it would be prohibited even without this language, but I wanted to make absolutely certain. So that's the reason for that subdivision 5 in the 2A amendment.
Someone want to move the 2A amendment?
I'll move the 2A
amendment. Representative Nelson moves the 2A amendment. Any other discussion? Anyone in the audience, please feel free to jump up if I forget to say anyone in the audience want to comment. All those in favor of the 2A amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Murphy on the 3A amendment. Do you want to amend the amendment or just go with it?
I could.
Do you want to take out Duluth?
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I'll move the 3A amendment with taking out, deleting the Duluth Teachers Retirement Association and out of there, though, that first line.
Okay. So, Representative Nelson incorporating that change into his motion of deleting on line 119 the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund Association and. Any discussion here? Please. Committee members?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Murphy.
I know that we asked a question, Mr. Doan, but we didn't ask if exactly that does St. Paul want the 3A to be included.
Mr. Doan, you kind of said yes from the back, but maybe you should come up to the microphone and say your comments.
Madam Chairman and members of the Commission, my name is Paul Doan, Executive Director of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement System. St. Paul has a slightly distinct or unique element here in terms of survivorship, and that survivorship with the St. Paul teachers must be an active member who has a spouse at the time they retire. But we do have situations where divorce decrees or other factors involving the marriage dissolution direct us to make certain payments and so forth. But generally speaking, the only person that can qualify for survivorship with St. Paul would be a living spouse, and not a living ex-spouse, but a living spouse. So the likelihood is remote of this being a factor, but I don't see any harm in having it included as far as St. Paul is concerned.
Anything else, Representative Murphy?
No.
Okay. Then on the motion to approve the 3A amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
As amended.
As amended. Yes. No, he incorporated it. He didn't amend it. Okay. On the bill, motion.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson moves that Senate file 573, House File 42000, as amended, be recommended to be included in Omnibus Bill 1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here who is not on the committee that would like to take up their bill next? Oh, there's Hortman. I was looking for you before. Representative Hortman. And Senate File no bill, no name. Happened to that bill.
Why is there two?
And Mr. Thompson, all right. Representative Hortman, if you would like to make some comments, and we could hear from your testifier and Mr. Thompson, and the staff will fill in.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 346 pertains to a constituent of mine who took leave back in the early 1990s and was not fully aware about that he could purchase service credit for the time that he was on leave. This is my first bill in front of the Pensions Commission, and I'm, of course, learning a lot as we go through the process regarding how notice is given to teachers when they're on leave, that they can continue to make contributions. Initially, it was my impression that that was the school district's responsibility, and we requested documentation from the school district and found out that they had not given notice, and so we felt that my constituent was entitled to some relief under the bill. Since moving forward through the Pension Commission process, I've learned from Luther Thompson that it's actually the TRA that gives notice to a teacher on leave about their right to continue to make contributions and to obtain the service credit. And that notice was given in 1992, but there was some confusion at the time because it was 1 year into Mr. Ryerson's leave, and it was a little bit unclear at the time. So, members, what I'm asking you today is to consider laying over the bill for possible inclusion in a future pension commission bill and not taking action today. We have started the conversation with the school district about some of the more complexity of this particular teacher's situation in the school district and are hoping to continue to work with the school district and see if there is a possible resolution to the situation.
Okay, from Mr. Thompson or the gentleman at the table, did you want to enlighten the commission anymore?
Madam Chair, I'd just like to give you just go through a couple of the facts. This Luther Thompson, representing TRA.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson.
Yeah, in '89, the school put Mr. Ryerson on a other leave, which isn't eligible for TRA coverage. In any case, in June of '92. They changed the last year of the other leave to the extended leave. So they made it retroactive back to July 1 of 1991. We then did send the notice to him, but you got to realize this is in the last month of the first year of the leave, so he's only got about 10 days to make the payment. Now, I don't know what transpired between the school and him at the time. There might have been some confusion over the switching of the other leave to the extended leave. Nobody seems to know exactly what conversations took place then. But we did send a letter out, and in order to pay for the leave, you have to pay for it by June 30th of that fiscal year, and we gave him the extra 30 days. But he might have been under the impression because of the lateness or because of the retroactivity, he may not have been eligible, but he never contacted TRA. I do have some, the cost estimates. If you allowed the full 5 years, which included the other leave, which was never really eligible, that's $110,000. That's the full actuarial cost. If you reduce it to the 3 years of the extended leave, that's $68,870. That's the full actuarial cost. And I also calculated if you only chose to buy 1 year, it would be $20,889. And that's really... What he's really doing is paying the cost, or he's really buying the benefit and paying the full cost of that additional amount. So the real benefit to him is, if there's other exigent circumstances or some relationship with the school, it really is just allowing him to perhaps, if he buys 1 year, he would be able to retire a year from now because that would give him the equivalent of 3 years. He gets the age, he gets the service, and by buying the 1 year. So that's an option as well, but that's really between the school. In any case, those are the numbers that would make TRA whole.
Okay. And you want to introduce yourself?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Joel Miltier. I'm the Manager of Employee Services for the Anoka-Hennepin School District, and I appreciate the conversations with Mr. Thompson and Representative Hortman regarding the fact that the school district is not the one that is responsible for stating to Mr. Ryerson his contributions to TRA and his responsibilities there. I do have a statement that the school district wanted me to share with the commission regarding the bill as it's written, and I'd like to share that with you if that's okay.
Please proceed.
The Anoka-Hennepin School District strongly opposes the bill HF 346 as it's written, and which holds that the school district is liable for Mr. Ryerson's own inaction regarding the TRA contributions during the time of his leave from his teaching position. There is no statutory or legal obligation requiring the school district to give notice to its employees regarding their right to continue TRA contributions during a leave of absence. The school district does not advise or counsel its employees regarding their retirement, as this is a service provided by the TRA. Passage of this bill may also result in significant financial cost to the school district, including but not limited to the potential layoff of a teacher or two, since we have no levy authority. In addition to passage of this bill may be precedent-setting, opening the door for any teacher in the state of Minnesota that did not purchase service credits during a leave period to make a claim against that district by simply stating that the district did not give notice, resulting in hundreds of thousands of dollars directed away from the education of our students across the state. The Anoka-Hennepin School District concurs with the position in Deputy Director Burek's memo to the Legislative Commission member stating, quote, any harm to Mr. Ryerson appears to be largely self-inflicted. What is clear is that Mr. Ryerson took an initial other leave or voluntary leave and then an extended leave of an absence with an expectation that these years would not be covered by the pension plan. If that was acceptable to him at the time, then it is unclear why the legislature should address this pension problem now through special legislation many years after these events occurred, when resolving his problem is more complicated and much more expensive. Again, I would reemphasize to the commission that the Anoka-Hennepin School District strongly opposes the bill as it's written. Thank you.
Okay, and Representative Hortman has requested that this bill be laid over for possible inclusion, and we have a couple different versions. The staff has come up, the A1 and the A2 amendments that you can consider if you want to come forward. And the Pension Commission still has several more weeks that we're meeting, so we'd be happy if you'd like to come back.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, Representative Hortman, is Mr. Ryerson, is he going to be able to come and testify on this, or is there
Representative Hortman.
Senator Rosen, Madam Chair, this is my first time at the Pension Commission, and I asked what the common practice was, and they said it's about 50-50, and he had an extracurricular activity after school today, and I said that I didn't think that it was required that he be here.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, then House File 346 is laid over. All right, thank you very much. Is Representative Dean here,
yeah,
or Senator Chamberlain?
Dean's over here. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's number 8 on the agenda.
Bitted.
Did I skip over Bly?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can I take Representative Bly? He's actually next.
Did he bring pie?
Number 5. Hopefully he'll be quick. Welcome to the Pension Commission.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. This is also my first time coming before the Pension Committee. So, and I have the bill that I'm bringing before you was brought to me by a constituent, Mr. Hermstead, who was employed by the City of Northfield as a bus driver in October 2005 and was not at that time informed of his right to receive para. He was informed April 2009. And then because of a decision of the City of Northfield where they discontinued the city bus service and went to an outsourcing nonprofit, he found himself without a job and discovered that this situation where he had not been receiving the para was something he wanted to try to do something about. And he contacted me, and I have Mr. Hermstead here.
Mr. Hermstead, welcome to the commission. Did you tell us a little bit more about your situation?
Well, I was a para member when I was at the Rosemont School District, 196. And I left, and I was getting close to retirement age, so I really did not think I would be going back into another para situation, but as it turned out, I did, and I was not given notification that I was eligible for para until 3.5 years after I was there. I had to reach a certain amount of income, you know, each month, actually, but I was well in excess of that. So then all of a sudden, one day in 2009, 4.5 years later, my employment part of our city came to me and said, did you notice there was more money in your check? And I said, yes, I did. And then I said, why is that? She says, well, because you're making more money. Well, I had been already, shortly after I was hired in October of 2005, I was already, had been employed there for 4 years. And I just... thought that it was the school district's responsibility.
The city, you mean?
The city, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. City's responsibility to give me get me on the para. And what I want to do is I want to try to put the para money, which I drew that out, and put that in my 401k. And when I asked them what I would have to do, other than talk to my representative, it would be to pay back, you know, the portion that I would have had to pay, which I don't know if we've got a number on that.
And according to the memo, that would be $5,300.
Yes, that seems about right.
Okay, could we hear from Ms. Vanek then from PERA? And then is anyone here from the city of Northfield? Do we know their position, Representative Bligh?
Okay. She'll speak to that.
All right, Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, members, Mary Vanek, PERA Director. In reviewing this case, we found that the only information we received from the city was that Mr. Hermstead was enrolled effective April 5th, 2009. And when he recently contacted our staff and spoke of the fact that he had started in 2005, when we made the inquiry of to the city, they verified that, yes, in fact, he should have been reported in 2005. He is no longer employed because of their decision to do something else he's no longer employed with the city, and therefore, under the current law, he cannot repay his refund. But in order to purchase service, all refunds must be repaid. So
was his refund about that amount?
We calculated his repayment of refund, Madam Chair, and that will be $16,308.80 for him to restore his past service. The cost of purchasing the time for which he wasn't reported is to Mr. Hermstead, contributions plus interest of $5,470.25, and the city would be responsible for the balance between that amount and the actuarial cost, or $8,879.95. I asked staff to contact the city yesterday. We received an email, and Elizabeth Wheeler, the director of HR for the city, sent us an email and said, "I just talked with the city's finance director regarding paying the $8,879.95 for Mr. Hermstead's para deductions plus interest. The city will pay this amount."
Okay. Great. And then my earlier question was, you said Mr. Hermstead had taken a refund?
Madam Chair, the record shows that when he left the school district in 2005, he requested a refund of what he had contributed. So we paid him a refund in August of 2005, and then when he was reinstated in April of 2009, deductions started again for his employment with the city of Northfield.
So how much was the refund?
The refund that he received was $5,776.41.
Oh, so close to what he has to pay back in.
No, the actual repayment of the refund is greater because there's interest compounded at 8.5% from the time he received the refund in August of 2005 until he repays it. So that the refund amount is $16,308.
But the city's paying $9,000 of that.
No. Madam Chair, no. That's just the repayment of his former refund. To purchase the service for which the city did not report him, he has to pay another $5,470.25, and the city has to pay $8,879.95, for a total of $14,350.20.
So how much will Mr. Hermstead be paying altogether? I'm
he
confused.
Will be, Madam Chair, he'll be paying a little over $21,000 to restore his past service and to get credit for the time that he wasn't reported.
Mr. Hermstead, you're willing to do this?
Yes.
Okay. Confusing. Okay, any other questions from members of the commission? Senator Rosen looked like she was also confused.
Yeah.
always.
Do I have a motion?
That's open.
Senator Rosen, what bill are we on? Bly. Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 594, House File 705, there's no amendments, be recommended to pass and included in Omnibus Bill 1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Bly. I told Senator Dahl he didn't have to be here. Representative Bly.
Yes.
I'll slow down here. Okay, now we can take Representative Dean. Thank you for your patience.
Eight.
This is number eight. Welcome to the commission.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the commission. Before you have you Senate File 96 with Senator Chamberlain and House File 156. This is brought to us by the White Bear Lake firefighters, and this deals with a death benefit of $2,000 to be paid out to less than 20 people who retired before 2008 when there was a law change by the legislature that changed the way that we dealt with the retirement, where they would receive their money at the time of retirement, not at the time of death. This would restore that benefit to, I think, 16 or so firefighters who retired before that time who were still living. This would be given to them, their surviving next of kin at the time of their death, if this is approved. And with me, I have from the White Bear Lake firefighters, I have Dan Brum.
And could you repeat your name, please? I didn't catch it.
Dan Brum.
Brum, Mr. Brum. Would you like to make any comments, Mr. Brum?
Yeah, since 1972 until the law was changed in July of 2009, the White Bear Lake Fire Department had a funeral benefit. In 1972, that benefit was $500, and believe it or not, that took care of a significant amount of the funeral costs in 1972. By 2009, it had increased to $2,000, and it really is a token against many funerals today. Over the years, the pension plan changed. 1972, there was a minimal pension. 1999, we adopted a lump sum program that allowed a firefighter to retire with $7,000 for each year of service. And so the funeral benefit was not available to those people. In 2009, we were here. We supported the change. We were very comfortable with eliminating the funeral benefit. There was an unintended consequence, though. We understood that the law would apply to future retirees, not to past retirees. It operates inequitably in regard to past firefighters. For instance, in 1984, we had eight of our firefighters retire. Four of them have died and collected that benefit. Four of them are still alive. All of them served 20 years or more. All of them met all the requirements for this benefit. And we don't think it's fair that simply because you died before your comrades that you should get a benefit that they don't. The other thing that's inequitable about it is today, if you look at what we as a relief association can provide, thanks to the legislature, we have very generous lump sum pension. The people that we're talking about retired under an old annuity program. It was not nearly as generous. Most of these people now are in their late 70s, their 80s. We have a couple in their 90s, and they retired with relatively small pensions compared to the ones that are available today. They also served, many of them served on the White Bear Lake Fire Department when it was truly a volunteer department. Today we have a generous pension. We get paid on call for every fire and rescue. We do 3,300 ambulance runs a year for which we are paid. So if you want to look at benefits or financial benefits, they're there now. The people I'm talking about served when White Bear Lake was truly a volunteer fire department. They left their business during the day. They got out of their warm beds at night. and they had no other reward but serving their fellow members of the community. We feel that it's unfair that this benefit, which is a token in today's world, but we feel that it's unfair that these people should not be able to collect this benefit. These are the ones who created the tradition of which we're a part. These are the ones who put the initial money into the Relief Association. These are the ones who came to the legislature and participated in the law that now has a wonderful effect. These are the ones who made the investments that in the 80s and 90s grew to the point that we have the plan. We feel that it's unfair that they're not entitled to this token of benefit. There's no cost to the state in this. This benefit has been in every actuarial study done by the White Bear Lake Fire Department since 1972. It's a closed group. We're not proposing that anybody who retired since 2009 be allowed into this. It's a group, it's a law that will sunset as these people die. So what we're asking is that you pass special legislation that authorizes us to pay from the special fund to all those who served 20 or more years, are collecting an annuity, and retired prior to the effective date of the law, July 1st, 2009.
Thank you, Mr. Brum. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I got two questions, one for Mr. Burrick. As stated, this only includes those, what I think he said, four people that we're talking about here?
I think Mr. Martin is
Mr. Martin.
The witness, members, identified four individuals. The author of the bill indicated perhaps 16. I have no way of knowing from the information I've got how many. Maybe one of the two witnesses can clarify.
Mr. Brum.
Yeah, my illustration was the eight that retired in 1984. We have had others retire, obviously, in other years. The sum total of the group was 28. I believe my numbers are right. 10 have died and collected the benefit. 2 have died since 2009 and, of course, not collected the benefit. And there are 16 who are living, remaining, who would be eligible for this benefit. So there's a total of 28 people in the class, 16 of them still alive.
Representative Dean, do you have a resolution from the city of White Bear Lake supporting this? Usually we like to have that. Mr. Broom.
May I, Madam
yes.
Chair? We have drafted a bylaw amendment that has been approved by the Relief Association and submitted to the finance director who sits on our Relief Association. And he and the city manager are in support of it. It has not been presented to the council, so we don't have a resolution from the city council. But the White Bear Lake Fire Department Relief Association has adopted the proposed bylaw.
We won't be passing this bill for a couple of weeks. Do you think you could get a resolution passed in the next couple of weeks?
You'd like one from the city council?
Yes.
Senator Pappas, I will ask for that, and we'll ask that it be approved at their next council meeting. I appreciate your heads up.
Thank you.
Representative
Nelson.
And I guess the other question I had was this: the way this is written, Mr. Martin or Mr. Burrick, it's not going to open it up for a whole bunch of other people. It's just these people that we're talking about, these 16 remaining survivors.
Yes.
Mr. Martin.
Yes, Madam Chair, a representative. This only applies to this one relief association, and it only applies to individuals who actually retired, terminated their firefighting service before the change in the law that got rid of death benefits.
Okay.
Representative Murphy.
Following up on that, Madam Chair, Mr. Martin, will other relief associations think that this could apply to them then in the future?
Madam Chair, Representative, a change like this could be followed by other relief associations who would argue that it's precedent for them. It clearly applies only to White Bear Lake, and so there would not be any confusion about the law as if it were enacted, but it clearly could be precedent. I'm not aware of how many relief associations provided this lump sum benefit. When it gets to casualty benefits, the relief associations differ. This also really only applies to should start back. Since 1979, lump sum volunteer fire pension plans, those that only provided a lump sum benefit, were only allowed to provide an active member survivor benefit, not a retired member survivor, or a service pension. They could only provide one benefit out of the pension plan because that's how they're funded. The liability calculation is for a single benefit only. So the bulk of the volunteer fire plans are lump sum plans and have not been allowed to do this since 1979. White Bear Lake was a monthly benefit plan. It shifted to being a combination plan, some lump sum, some monthly benefit plans. There are about 20 of those combination plans around. There are, I believe, 7 monthly benefit plans still around. So the possible universe is probably under 30 of pension plans that could even have this sort of problem at all. But, yes, one of those 30 could come in and say, we're just like White Bear Lake, and why don't you do the same thing?
Any other questions from members of the commission? Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Martin, can you please explain the OLA report that was out? It talks about this on page 2, second or third paragraph, really the elimination of funeral benefits.
Members, Madam Chair.
For the state auditor,
the middle,
I'm sorry.
Page 2, this is the most recent actuarial information that's available to us. And because the compilations of the actuarial work and the other financing information for the volunteer fire community is filed with the Office of the State Auditor in a less than timely fashion in some cases, and it takes a while to put the whole compilation together. We're always about a year late. So the most recent information is 2010. This plan does not have an unfunded liability. It has a surplus. It's about 113% funded as of 2010. And you can get a sense of the size of the financial requirements for the plan and the size of the fire state aid that provides the sole support for this plan.
Any other questions from members of the commission? The least costly the bill, the longer we talk about it.
Yeah.
Can I have a motion?
Well,
Madam Chair. Senator Johnson?
Were you going to wait till they got the letter from the city council? Or?
I don't think we have to wait for it. I think as long
as
it's okay with me.
Yeah, right?
As long as it comes before we pass the final bill.
Wasn't somebody calling me?
I mean, it has to be approved by the city council before it becomes effective. So there's another.
I think Madam Chairman, I think we've always passed the bills with this in it and then have them come afterwards.
Madam Chair, members, this does require local approval before the law becomes effective. In order to not waste any more legislative time on it, we want to, it's the historical practice to ask the locality if they're supportive. Because there's no point in pursuing the law if the locality is going to simply veto it or not adopt it. So we're simply looking for their sense before we
take final action.
Take additional time out to do it.
Okay, Senator Johnson moves that Senate Bill 96, House File 156, be recommended to pass and incorporated into Omnibus Bill 1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Let's take number 9 on the agenda because I think it's really short.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you.
We haven't done 7. Okay, they're both my bills. Number 9 is the State Auditor's Volunteer Fire Working Group bill. We do not have bills.
We tried it.
Senator Murphy, do you have lost in your committee, in your office?
This bill.
Jesus. Do you know where your bills are?
It's in transit. It's Madam Chair, Rose Hennessy Allen, Pension Director with the State Auditor's Office. I spoke with the Revisor's Office, and it was delivered to Representative Murphy's office, so I'm checking with staff to locate it. But
that's right.
Hopefully it will be before you soon.
Okay. Well, the staff has told me that this is a pretty modest technical bill.
Yep, that's correct. Most of the changes in the bill are technical. They received unanimous consent by the working group members.
They didn't come forward?
I'll keep my comments unless there are questions just to the substantive changes within the bill. And they were identified as potential policy issues in the staff memo.
Do you speak up a little bit, please?
Sure. Section 4, which is on page 2, clarifies the return to service authorization for volunteer firefighters. And the changes clarify that certain requirements of the return to service provision do not apply to leaves of absence made available by federal or state statutes, such as military or FMLA leaves. Currently, the statute exempts leaves of absence that are mandated by federal or state law. And this language in the current statute
was... Ms. Hennessey, would you stop for a minute? I just want to make sure we're all looking at the right bill. And I can't even follow where you are. So we're on, we have a revisor bill 131824, the back of the packet. Okay. And so what did you say about...
So it's page 2 of the bill. It's
okay, what about page 1 of the bill? I missed that.
Page 1 is purely technical changes.
Okay.
Let's see. It defines... And just defines which sections of apply to different relief associations. So it's a purely technical change.
Covered relief associations. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Section 2 is a technical change that ensures that defined contribution relief associations are included in the state fire aid program. There was some recodification a few years ago, and this technical change is needed just to make sure that they are eligible for fire state aid. On page 2, section 3, we define the term fiscal year. That term isn't defined for relief associations right now, so we wanted to add the definition to statute. So again, that would be a technical change. Section 4 is return to service changes. And currently the statute exempts leaves of absence that are mandated by federal or state law. And this language was seen as being vague, so the working group members thought that having a list of examples of what could be a qualifying exemption would be helpful. So those are the changes in Section 4. Section 5 begins on page 5 of the bill. This is another technical change, just making some wording changes to clean up the statutes and make it easier to administer for the plans. Section 6 on page 6 of the bill deletes some outdated language. It's authorizing transfers to an IRA, and transfers to an IRA are not authorized in the payment of a death benefit. There aren't, because the language isn't needed, it's a technical change to just delete that term. Section 7, again, a technical change for defined contribution plans. We just wanted to clarify that they have to complete minimum service and membership requirements in Subdivision 2. We're referring back to some requirements that are already specified for those plans. So, again, a technical wording change. Section 8 is a substantive change. This makes changes to how deferred interest is calculated and paid for certain members of defined benefit relief associations. The modifications clarify that municipal ratification of deferred interest rates set by the Relief Associations Board is always required, and it defines when those deferred interest rates become effective. It's currently unclear in statute if municipal ratification is always required for deferred interest rates or only required if the relief association is underfunded. So the working group discussed this issue and decided that it wanted municipal ratification of interest rates to always be required. The group thought that this would be clearer and an easier process for relief associations to administer. So that's what's being changed in Section 8. Sections 9, 10, and 11 begin on page 9. And these three sections contain changes to the supplemental survivor benefit. And this benefit is an additional benefit paid by a relief association upon the death of an active or deferred firefighter. The benefit is equal to 20% of the survivor benefit distribution up to a maximum of $2,000. It is paid to the surviving spouse or surviving children of the deceased firefighter. And there's a similar type of supplemental benefit that's paid to service pension recipients. This benefit is reimbursed by the state and is intended to help offset income taxes that may be due on the benefit distribution. Relief associations are required to pay the benefit to service pension recipients, but are only allowed to pay the benefit to survivor benefit recipients if the bylaws allow for it. Most relief associations haven't amended their bylaws to authorize the payment yet, and so what happens is that firefighters pass away, the relief association pays the benefit out, but their bylaws haven't authorized the payment. So these sections eliminate the requirement that the bylaws authorize the supplemental survivor benefit before it can be paid. So this change will improve the administration of the supplemental benefit program.
Okay. And then the repealer is an obsolete section of law?
Yep, that's correct, Madam Chair.
And who else do we have at the table?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Dave Ganfield. I'm the administrator of the Apple Valley Firefighters Relief Association, retired member of that department after 22 years of service. Actually, all of this goes back to the working group starting in 04, 05. And what that essentially did with the help of Executive Director Martin, members from around the state of the different types of volunteer fire reliefs, we started getting together and discussing some of the problems we were having in the different styles of reliefs. So through the years, we've started to get pretty good at figuring out where the problems are, how we can help improve those things with other reliefs. The auditor's office often brings up some technicalities, problems they're having in making determinations because of vagueness in certain statutes, that sort of thing. So many times we're just working on clarifying language so that everybody understands throughout the state, because you have roughly 700 and some relief associations out there. So we have to work out on how everything's going to work out. All of this has come through the group. We have a full consensus of all the different types of relief associations. That's the only time any recommendations get moved through, is when the whole group agrees on it. So it's been well reviewed by that. Mr. Martin's had a good chance to mainly educate us, because he's got the background that goes back for much further than any of us seem to remember all the time. So very great to have that knowledge on that commission, too, or on this working group.
Any questions from members of the commission? Anyone else in the audience want to testify?
It's a good bill.
All right. Senator Murphy moves that the reviser bill number 13-1824 be recommended to pass and incorporated into Omnibus Bill 1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
I can have the bill.
Now I don't have
to. Okay, let's do number 7, Senate File 274, House File 340, Ms. Vanek. Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair and members, this is a very simple bill. We are administering the statewide retirement plan for those volunteers who choose to participate in this plan. And currently, there's a 90-day period from the time we present to the city or the governing body the cost of joining this plan to when they have to get authority through their governing board to approve it. And there are some smaller entities who have asked for a longer period, so we're asking to extend that period from 90 days to 120 days.
I move.
Okay, Senator Murphy moves. That Senate File 274, House File 340, be recommended to pass and incorporated into Omnibus Bill 1. Any questions? Got to ask that. Anyone else want to testify? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay. This is great. Then the last bill, if Mr. Kolodziejski would like to come forward, is Senate File 280, House File 341, and Mr. Bergstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Richard Kajewski. I'm the Public Affairs and Communications Director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees.
Did I say the wrong name? Number 345. Also, yeah. I'm sorry. Proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently, MSRS is a governmental plan regulated by the IRS Code 401A. An IRS code does allow for a de minimis number of employees of a nonprofit to participate in plans like that of the general plan. IRS Code 501c5 defines the nonprofits to include a labor organization. MSRS has issued us a statement stating that our group meets the requirements of being de minimis. With the 2A amendment, Madam Chair, that's, I believe, before the commission, we have 17 employees with two additional vacancies. The purpose of the amendment, I see it's going around now, is we currently have, since this would be new to our organization, we have one person on staff who is already retired and receiving an annuity under the MSRS plan. There's a past history of including these groups. In fact, currently in the statute, MMA and MGRC, I think they're added in 2007, 2008, if my memory serves me correct, they're currently participating in the MSRS plan. We're motivated by a few factors. Currently,
Senator Nelson moves the 2A amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're motivated by a few factors. Currently, state employees who come to work for MAPE, if they come from a MAPE job class in state government, they can take a leave of absence and maintain their service with the MSRS general plan. If they come from any other bargaining unit or non-bargaining unit, for that matter, from the state of Minnesota, or from the private sector, for that matter, they cannot participate in the plan. And that applies to several of our staff who have come and some who have gone in past years, and we'd like to remain in that plan when we possibly can and be consistent with the members that we represent. We're not asking to purchase any back service credit with this bill. The vesting requirements would be the same. And currently, our employer has agreed to pay the 5% employer contribution and any future increases, and our employees have agreed to pay their 5% employee share with any future increases as well. We've heard, and I'm going to address it. We've heard one concern that this is a some sort of big benefit for a long-term executive director of ours. The reality is he has announced his retirement. We've hired his replacement. He will be leaving us and leaving service with us at the end of May. His contract is expired. We're not negotiating a new contract with him, and he will not be vested in MSRS. So this, in fact, doesn't even apply to our previous executive director. So with that, I'm sure Dave Bergstrom can answer any questions regarding facts and figures, but I'm happy to address any other questions that the members have. Thank you.
Questions from members? Mr. Bergstrom. Any additional comments?
Madam Chair, Dave Bergstrom, the director of the State Retirement System. MSRS board does not have a position on this. The middle management was added in 07 and 2008. It's not a financial issue. There are 17 people out of 49,000 active. It's not going to matter financially. They will contribute. They have to contribute under law. And the IRS does allow a de minimis group, so it's the IRS issue is not an issue. We did actually receive a favorable determination letter from the IRS just about a year and a half ago, and the members of MGEC and middle management were included in that review, so they did not have a problem at that time, and this group, you know, is small enough, so we certainly wouldn't be an issue.
Mr. Martin, would you explain the 1A amendment?
Yes, members. The 1A amendment is not something that MAPE is looking for, but We've previously, members have had two labor unions seek MSRS general plan coverage. This is the third. There are a few more labor unions that the state does deal with. And if we're seeing a trend line here, this could anticipate that trend by doing it for all state unions.
Okay. We have questions? Yes. Representative Benson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure if it's to Mr. Bergstrom. Probably so. Burke. Either or.
Mr. Martin.
I guess Mr. Martin. I think he just stated something that's alarming to me, and that is currently being that this organization through the IRS is de minimis, but how about the rest of the organizations? And do at some point do we begin to have a problem with the IRS when we begin every labor organization with employees who have never worked for the state before now enter the system?
Mr. Martin.
Madam Chair, yes, Representative, at some point, if there were a large enough membership in the various public employees that the state deals with, it could get beyond de minimis. I have no idea how many employees are employed by the unions that have not already been put into MSRS, but my sense is that they're not very numerous. But I don't know the exact numbers. And the de minimis question with the IRS is a judgment call that they make, and in looking at past decisions, at least up to a couple of years ago, it varied quite a bit. They fairly large numbers in a very big plan. Hundreds of people in a plan that covers tens of thousands is still considered de minimis.
Madam
Chair. MSRS is at 48,000 active members.
Representative Benson.
We've got a couple of weeks. Do we need to get some further clarification from the IRS before we open the door? My only question is, this may only be a few employees, but I don't know how many other organizations that could be possibly before this group, not this year, of course, but in the future, and that might change. And then we're suddenly in conflict. So do we need to ask for further clarification before we would?
Mr. Martin, I suppose we could survey what other public unions there are, public employee unions besides AFSCME would be one. SEIU might be another, and to see how large their staffs are. We certainly could do that. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess I was going to, that's kind of along the line of my question. I was leaning towards including the 1A amendment, which would bring the other organizations in, but before I would do that, I'd want to ask Mr. Bergstrom what his opinion on that would be on the 1A amendment.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair.
You probably know what they are.
I know one. I know AFSCME would be the largest union that we have, and I'm about 99% sure they have their own retirement plan.
Okay.
So they would not be interested in that amendment because they now would have double coverage. So I think before you put that amendment on, I think I would ask the various unions, but that would be by far the largest that we would have. And
okay. Ms. Crockett, are you interested in testifying? We have you on the list. Please come to the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kim Crockett with Center of the American Experiment. I'm here to address the policy issue this evening, and want to note at the outset that the pension system, as reported, is $16.7 billion underfunded, as I understand it, as of January, and that the state has not made its actuarial required contribution, I believe, since 2008 or 2007. It's in good company. There are about 30 other states that haven't either, but nonetheless, that's alarming. There is myriad legislation in front of you this session to shore up this defined benefit that has been promised to state employees. So even if the system were at 120% funding tonight, I would be alarmed from a policy standpoint. I would be alarmed if I were a public employee who was relying on this system for her retirement. And I would want to know.
Ms. Crockett?
Yes.
Excuse me for interrupting you, but next week we're going to be talking where we have benefit bills.
Yes.
Up, and your comments might be more appropriate then, because this is just really a little small issue about whether the union members that MAVE can join MSRS. And we're talking like 16.
Yeah, that was just a preface to to commenting on this bill.
Good.
Because I'd just like to remind people of how big the unfunded liability is, including public employees who are good enough to come down here and attend these sessions. I don't know that they're aware of how large the unfunded liability is for their pension fund. So what I would want to know if I were a public employee is, what is the reason for extending membership to labor representatives? What is the state's interest in providing a pension to these particular individuals? And if there is some reason, is there some sort of limiting principle for this? Now, if the reason is that they used to be public employees, then the state, to be consistent, needs to extend membership in the public pension fund to all former public employees. Or otherwise, this is just a deal for labor negotiators who used to be public employees. And what are the optics of that? MAPE labor representatives are employees in the private sector. They made a decision at some point in their career to take that particular job. And for that reason, and that reason alone, I would conclude that they are not eligible for a public pension any more than they would be eligible for health care benefits or OPEB benefits or anything else. Those are benefits of a public employee. Thank you. And I would be happy to come back next week and other times to talk about the bigger policy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Crockett. Representative Nelson.
I'd just like to correct one thing that Ms. Crockett said, is that these employees that were working for the state and took jobs with their unions are not past employees. They are on leave without pay, so they are current employees. And so, therefore, they're not past employees that are coming out of nowhere. These are employees that they took a leave to take the job with the union to represent themselves and their fellow state employees. And if they were to leave that employment with the union, they can step back into their job without losing, they'll have the break in service, but without losing their seniority or anything else that they are as public employees. They are still public employees.
Madam Chair?
Ms. Crockett.
I wondered about that myself, and just refer you to the staff memo, item number one under policy issues, and maybe there's been a change in this, states that there's a concern about the appropriateness of extending retirement coverage to state employee union employees who are not state employees on a leave of absence. So it's I don't know which one is correct, but the staff memo would indicate that they are not on a leave of absence at this time.
Mr. Kolodziejski.
Madam Chair, members, some employees who go to the bargaining union, if you will, from a position represented by that bargaining unit, are permitted to take a leave of absence, and we do have some of them on staff, and we have in the past, and we do currently today. Other members, so for instance, if an AFSCME member or a middle management employee is hired by MAPE, for example, they are required to sever their service with MSRS.
So this legislation would?
It would treat them consistently. It would treat all the staff consistently and make them eligible to.
They'd be able to stay in MSRS. Yeah.
Ding. Madam Chair, I guess my only concern is that we're also extending it to folks that have never spent any time in state service, and that might be a small percentage, but nevertheless, it wouldn't be any different than working for one of the lobbyists that are here, and then they decide they're going to go work for MAPES, never having any experience in state, and now we're going to say that we're going to include them. So that's the biggest piece of this that I have some problem with. I don't know if we can carve that out in an amendment or not, but I guess I'm not for extending it to folks who have not been part of the state government workforce in the past.
We do have a precedent in that we have extended coverage to the operating engineers and the Middle Management Association. So we've already kind of gone down that road, if you will. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering who can answer this question for me. But clearly there's some IRS precedent for this. If the IRS allows for a de minimis number, and I'm not sure if that precedent is set on the federal level or multiple other states for whether they were ever a state employee at one point or another, and there was a reason for this. Do we have any history behind that IRS provision that anyone could answer and what the precedent is for it?
Who would like to say?
Well, Madam Chair, members,
Mr. Martin.
I have looked at the issue of the de minimis standard in tax qualification. I haven't looked at it in the last couple of years, but when I did look at it, I reviewed 15, 20 instances where the federal government had ruled on the question. Because ERISA plans, and it's really a question of does ERISA apply in full or not, it covers health insurance, health coverage plans, as well as pension plans. So some of the de minimis questions I was looking at were not purely pension plans, but were the question was, were these public employees, were they employees of government? And it runs a considerable number from a one or two or three people in a small pension plan are still considered de minimis to several people in a much larger plan. And there is no particular printed standard. There is no explicit standard. It's a judgment call. But clearly, a few employees in a plan that has tens of thousands of members would be de minimis. Exactly where the breakpoint is not clear. That was the conclusion I came to with after looking at more than a dozen, probably two dozen of these rulings.
Well, Madam Chair, I ask that through the lens of Representative Benson's question, if it's a matter of principle, that no, you just don't extend it because someone did not. They moved from negotiating for AFSCME to negotiating for MAPE. But it strikes me that because that provision is there, it's obviously been considered by multiple governmental agencies previously, and that's the reason why you can have a small number. So I understand the principled exception, Representative Benson, but I think that's why the IRS standard was there, and I'm satisfied with it.
Any other questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Were we going to scope this and find out maybe how big that pool was, and maybe tonight's not the night to have that decision made specifically? We know what the issue is.
I think if no one offers the 1A amendment, then we're just back to the MAPE issue.
Okay. Let me ask this question, then, Madam Chair, if I could. Is it something that the Commission wants to scope and so that we don't deal with this in the future and we deal with it today?
I think that we could adopt the legislation, and then we could reconsider the amendment at a later meeting.
And, Madam Chair, to that, I was also wondering, since we had discussion earlier tonight about unions and other bargaining units, if we were going to be considering Duluth and St. Paul teachers as a part of this as well, since this committee does have jurisdiction. Don't know specifically how it applies, but for scoping the issue, we should look at the bigger picture.
Representative O'Driscoll, I think the staff did talk about the potential union specification on page 2 of the memo.
Members, if you, in a background piece that's connected or attached to your memo, if you turn to page 4 of the memo, it's the start of the background piece, it's attachment A. In the first part, which is the first half or two-thirds of page 4, is a comparison of the current membership provisions related to government labor organization employees. The first-class city teachers have no provision in 354A. So even a Duluth school teacher who is on leave and would be employed by the union, there is no provision for including that person in the Duluth Teacher Pension Fund at the current time.
Thank you.
Interesting. Okay. Any other questions? And Representative Nelson moves that Senate File 280, House File 345 be recommended to pass and included in Pension Bill 1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, members, I think our work is completed for the evening. And just remember, next week we're meeting at 7 o'clock instead of 5:30. The meeting is adjourned.
Representative, next week I'm actually doing this thing at the science museum.
7 o'clock is when my favorite show comes on.